Well, good morning and welcome. I'm Frank Verastra. I'm Senior Vice President, CSIS, and Head of the Energy and National Security Program here, and it's my pleasure to have you all here today as we commemorate the one-year anniversary of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, the stimulus program. We actually thought briefly about having a birthday cake here this morning so you could have with your coffee, but as we are a think tank, and in think tank land, the idea of deficit spending, not a good thing. So we'll forego those opportunities. I should also say that when we first conceived the idea of this event, and I want to point out that Sarah Ladislaw and Lee Hendricks and Lisa Hyland and Itzhak Goldberger were really kind of the brains behind this, the concept of this. We wanted a balanced approach. We talked about the major spending that went on when we actually took on stimulus spending, both for economic reasons and also to reset the energy system. And we concur with the assessment that we need to reset the system for a variety of reasons. Mostly above-ground reasons, but it's security, it's an environment, it's investment, it's governance, it's concentration of resources. Things need to be done. But that said, we're spending an awful lot of money. The DOE now has $40 billion that David's going to talk about with a total budget in the past of less than 30. So this is an enormous spend, and it's focused on efficiency and renewables and technology and research. But the question is, how sustainable is some of this going forward? So we've got a panel discussion following David's presentation this morning, and we want to examine some of those questions. So we want to look at light of, so what happens after in light of deficit spending and no price on carbon, how do you sustain this jumpstart of a green economy, right? So if you push on the supply side, what do you do on the demand pull side? What happens down the road if the United States acts and other countries are already doing things? Where does that put us competitively? And without the price of carbon, how do you actually set a system that going forward helps you attain and sustain your environmental, energy security, and economic goals? And so this is not an easy lift. We asked David this morning to spend some time in talking about the U.S. program and the Department of Energy spend. Matt Rogers had originally, if you were part of our early mailing, had originally decided to come here and had to postpone or cancel at the last minute, and David was generous and good enough to allow us to put his name on the agenda and bring him forward this morning, so we very much appreciate that. He's got some commitments back at DOE, so we're going to have him give some remarks, take a few questions, and then we'll proceed with the second panel. In your current situation, so David, for those of you actually who know him, he's Assistant Secretary for Policy and International Affairs. So in addition to the U.S. role, and we really do want to look at what DOE has spent, what they continue to spend, what their criteria is, and what the challenges are in getting the money out the door, we're going to ask him also to spend some time looking across on a global spectrum to actually put some of this in context. So we appreciate you coming. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce David Sandalo, have him come up here. This would be a great time, though, if you could turn off your cell phones out of courtesy to our speakers and also the people around you, and we'll be able to get going. David, thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Frank. It's great to be here at CSIS. I am a longtime admirer, not just of Frank's work, but of the work of this think tank more broadly. CSIS does great work on geopolitics. It does great work on energy policy. So I'm delighted to be here. It's actually a terrific place to make an announcement not related to the topic of today's conference, but can announce today that Secretary Chu is going to travel to the Mideast next week and will be in Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar next week. He follows trips there by Deputy Secretary Dan Poneman, who is in the region in December, and by the head of our ARPA-E program, Arun Majumdar, who was in Qatar last month. And this series of high-level meetings reflects the priority that we attach at the Department of Energy to our relationships in the region. Turning to today's very timely topics, a few thoughts. Let me start with Sam Fortune. Sam Fortune Jr. is a single father of three in Coshocton, Ohio. He lost his job during the Christmas week in 2007 and struggled for more than a year to find work. Finally, he saw an ad in a local paper announcing a job as a heating technician under a local home weatherization program. Sam got the job, and has been helping people in his community cut heating bills ever since. Elizabeth Rolinski is a plant manager for Johnson Controls, which is a 125-year-old American company. Rolinski is in charge of reopening the company's Holland, Michigan manufacturing facility, which will make next-generation lithium-ion batteries. The plant will provide more than 550 manufacturing jobs and is expected to produce at least three times as many indirect jobs in the Holland, Michigan community. And Michael Harvey is chief technical officer at ZeroCoat, a California startup that makes parts for solar energy systems. A year ago, Harvey was having trouble finding funding for a small but promising project to lower the cost of solar energy. It looked like the company would fall behind foreign competitors. But today, ZeroCoat is pursuing that project and has already created five new jobs in the process. Now, what do all these people have in common? Along with millions of Americans, each one is doing work made possible by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, landmark legislation signed into law by President Obama just 1 year ago today. The Recovery Act was a sweeping economic recovery package designed to help rescue a nation on the edge of economic abyss. For millions of Americans, its impacts have already been profound. Public and private forecasters ranging from the Council of Economic Advisers to Moody's Economy and IHS Global now say that the Recovery Act is responsible for about 2 million jobs nationwide. And the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, widely respected by members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, says that the numbers of jobs created could be as high as 2.4 million. Now, furthermore, within this legislation was the largest one-time investment in clean energy in U.S. history. So when I received your invitation to come speak at this timely conference, I was delighted to accept. I thought I could use it as a platform for both taking stock of our progress to date and offering thoughts on the road ahead. So to take stock of progress, let's start by recalling where we were just 1 year ago. In December 2008, the U.S. economy lost 673,000 jobs. In January 2009, it lost 779,000 jobs. The economy was in free fall. As a result of the financial crisis, affordable credit had dried up. Many Americans were unable to access loans for their businesses, education, and mortgages. Home values were plummeting, and across the political spectrum, there was real fear of another Great Depression. Congress responded with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which President Obama signed less than 1 month after taking office. The act pledged $786 billion to pull the economy back from the brink. It was divided into three parts. One-third was for tax cuts for small businesses and working families. One-third was for emergency relief, extending unemployment benefits, reducing the cost of health insurance, and providing assistance to state and local governments facing enormous budget shortfalls. And a final third was for investments to put Americans to work on critical projects to help us keep competitive in the 21st century. This includes computerizing medical records, medical research, renovating classrooms, upgrading roads and railways, and most important for our discussion today, making historic investments in clean energy. And that's where the Department of Energy comes in. I've worked at several places in the federal government. Before last year, I'd never worked at the Department of Energy. I can report to you as that the DOE's mission is wide-ranging. DOE is the manager of our nation's nuclear arsenal and the associated environmental cleanup. It's the largest funder of basic science research in the nation, and it's the agency in charge of clean energy technology deployment. In fact, it's a very exciting time to be at the Department of Energy. That's true for several reasons. I think it's true in large part because we have a transformational leader in Energy Secretary Stephen Chu. As many people here know, Dr. Chu was awarded the 1997 Nobel Prize in Physics. 5 years ago, he changed the course of his career to focus on energy, leaving Stanford to direct the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. I must say, I sometimes sit in budget meetings and I wonder, what was it like before the Secretary of Energy knew more about most topics he's being briefed on than most people briefing him? Secretary Chu is also, he's a superb manager. This is important for any organization the size of and breadth of DOE, but I think it's especially important because of the topic that we're here to discuss today. DOE's annual budget for energy science and for energy science and cleanup programs is roughly $17 billion. Through the Recovery Act alone, DOE received almost $37 billion in appropriations. And these funds must be awarded in less than 20 months by September 30 of this year and spent very promptly. And so at DOE, we faced an enormous challenge. The Recovery Act asks us to manage more money than we've ever had on tighter timetables, giving money to more entities than ever before. To meet this challenge, Secretary Chu brought in a team of highly qualified managers and experts. The leader of these efforts, as Frank has already referred to, is Matt Rogers, the Secretary's Senior Advisor for Recovery Act Implementation. Matt comes to DOE from McKinsey & Company, where he was a senior partner with more than 20 years' experience in the energy industry. He is also, quite simply, one of the most talented and dedicated public servants that I've ever known. He and his team have worked tirelessly to lead the department in spending DOE's $37 billion in Recovery Act funds with speed, transparency, and accountability. Now, in making these historic investments, DOE has had six substantive goals, and I thought I would spend the bulk of my time today talking with you about them. First, our first goal has been to dramatically improve energy efficiency, saving Americans billions of dollars. Under the Recovery Act, we're making the largest single investment in home energy efficiency in U.S. history. For low-income families that are hit hardest by utility bills, the Recovery Act provides $5 billion for the Weatherization Assistance Program, which funds local agencies to perform home energy audits and weatherization services. As a result of the Recovery Act, we expect to weatherize about 650,000 homes for low-income families by the end of the year, improving energy efficiency and cutting energy costs. Over the next several years, our investments will help millions more Americans cut utility bills by making their homes and appliances more energy efficient. Within the Recovery Act is an expanded tax credit for energy efficiency, which covers upgrades up to 30% of the cost of improving your home up to a cost of $1,500. The Recovery Act also includes $3.1 billion for DOE's state energy program, showcasing cooperation between federal and state agencies. Historically, the state energy program and its partners saved more than $7 in energy costs and leveraged non-federal investments of over $10 for every dollar of federal investment. And the Recovery Act also funded for the first time $3.2 billion in energy efficiency and conservation block grants, which will assist cities, counties, states, territories, and Indian tribes to develop their own efficiency programs. This will include improvements in building codes, energy audits and retrofits, efficient public lighting, and landfill gas capture. As part of this block grant program, we've launched an innovative effort called Retrofit Ramp Up. It's going to award almost $400 million for innovative programs to provide whole neighborhood building energy retrofits. These projects will demonstrate a sustainable business model for providing cost-effective energy upgrades for a large percentage of the buildings in a given community. So the first goal that we've identified and pursued is dramatically improving energy efficiency. A second is building the strongest renewable energy industry in the world. Recovery Act investments totaling $23 billion will put us on track to doubling both renewable energy generation and advanced energy manufacturing by 2012, while leveraging over $43 billion in additional investment. We expect these investments to create hundreds of thousands of jobs. We're funding across the range of renewable energy technologies in the power mix, including wind, solar, geothermal, hydro, and efficiency. We're also investing both in research and development and deployment of renewable energy. As just one example, up to $24 million in Recovery Act funding has gone to three universities around the nation to improve land-based and offshore wind turbine performance. I was in Maine recently, where experts told me they called Maine the Saudi Arabia of offshore wind. And they said that wind resources there could provide enough electric power for the entire state in the decades ahead. At the same time, the Recovery Act has so far provided more than $2 billion in so-called Section 1603 grants in lieu of tax credits, where energy producers receive cash up front instead of waiting for tax credits, which has helped companies access the capital they need to deploy renewable energy now. So by the end of the year, we'll have supported more than 15 gigawatts of new wind, solar, and geothermal, enough to power 4 to 5 million homes. Our domestic renewable energy industry has made clear that the Recovery Act has been crucial to unlocking financing for these kinds of projects in recent months. DOE has also worked closely with the Treasury Department on the tax credit for clean energy manufacturing under Section 48C. The President announced last month that 183 manufacturers in 43 states would receive $2.3 billion in tax credits. The interest was extraordinary. The program has been oversubscribed by 3-1. Now, instead of turning down worthy applicants, President Obama and Vice President Biden have called for Congress to provide an additional $5 billion to expand the program. Because there's already a deep pipeline of projects, these funds will be deployed quickly to create jobs and support economic activity. So a first substantive goal is in efficiency, a second in renewable energy, a third goal is in transforming transportation. I have to say, as I was working on and writing this speech, the numbers just in the billions of dollars and the extraordinary number of projects here, it's just overwhelming. And for example, in the transportation area, we're investing more than $4 billion with Recovery Act funding to develop the next generation of vehicles, plus $8.5 billion so far from our Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Loan Program. These programs are going to transform the transportation sector, supporting electric and natural gas vehicles, advanced biofuels, and projects that will improve the efficiency of internal combustion engines. Over the next 6 years, three new electric vehicle plants, the first ever in the United States, and 30 new battery and other electric vehicle manufacturing plants will be fully operational. We've made investments in battery and component suppliers like A123, Enerdell, and Celgard, as well as manufacturers like Nissan, Tesla, Fisker, and Ford, to make advanced vehicles right here in the United States. These plants will have the capacity to produce 250,000 electric drive cars and batteries to power 500,000 plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. We're also building the infrastructure to support these vehicles, including more than 10,000 charging locations in a dozen cities. We've awarded $300 million in Recovery Act grants to 25 clean city coalitions. These grants significantly expand city and county-led efforts to reduce petroleum consumption, deploying high-efficiency cars, trucks, and buses. At the same time, Recovery Act investments are supporting the development and deployment of the next generation of biofuels. Over $600 million in Recovery Act grants, along with federal loan guarantees, will support 19 pilot demonstration and commercial-scale biorefineries. These facilities will convert biomass into fuels and chemicals that otherwise would be produced from oil, creating jobs and raising incomes in rural communities across the nation. Before these investments, the development of advanced biofuels industry was at a virtual standstill, as numerous facilities at the pilot stage faltered during the economic downturn. And more than $100 million from the Recovery Act, plus an additional $87 million from other sources, will go to improving the freight hauling efficiency of heavy-duty trucks and the fuel efficiency in passenger vehicles by up to 40%. And finally, in the transport sector, the Recovery Act grants totaling $8 billion will spur the development of America's first nationwide program of high-speed intercity passenger rail service. The awards will go to develop 13 new large-scale high-speed rail corridors across the country. It's the Department of Transportation, not DOE, which is in the lead on these high-speed rail investments. So efficiency, renewables, and transportation. A fourth area is in building a 21st century power infrastructure. Our electric grid is a critical piece of infrastructure, but today it uses century-old technology. It's been said that Thomas Edison would recognize very well our modern electric infrastructure if he came back and saw it today. The infrastructure wastes too much energy, it costs us too much money, and it's too susceptible to outages and blackouts. Just as President Eisenhower's investment in an interstate highway system revolutionized the way Americans travel, our Recovery Act investments in the smart grid and new transmission lines will revolutionize how we produce, transport, and use energy. More than $4 billion in Recovery Act smart grid investments will be matched by more than $5.5 billion in private sector funding for nearly 140 projects that will reduce costs, increase reliability, and give consumers more choice and control over their energy use. These investments will support the installation of 18 million smart meters, which allow homeowners to monitor energy use by the month, week, or even the hour. By 2015, we expect a combination of public and private investment to lead to the deployment of 40 million smart meters nationally. The Recovery Act is also funding the installation of over 1,000 sensors on the electric transmission system to improve reliability and security for the first time, covering the entire U.S. transmission system. We expect these investments to create tens of thousands of jobs. A fifth area is demonstrating carbon capture and storage, and demonstrating that CCS can be economical in 8 to 10 years. With $3.4 billion from the Recovery Act, along with funds from other programs, we are making unprecedented investments in CCS, already attracting roughly $7 billion in private capital. Projects we're supporting are projected to capture 12 million tons of CO2 annually by 2015 and much more in the years beyond. Realizing the promise of low-carbon electricity from coal requires an economical solution to capturing CO2. The leading processes today are amine and ammonia-based processes that cost $60 per ton and have a very significant energy penalty, which has prevented them from reaching widespread commercial implementation. New CO2 capture technologies, using different solvents, adsorbents, and absorbents, hold the promise to significantly reduce the energy penalty, cut capital costs, and reduce the cost per ton by more than half. Our grants are funding entirely new approaches, such as synthetic enzymes or conversion of CO2 into valuable fuels and chemicals that could reduce the cost even more. And a final sixth area is reestablishing U.S. leadership in science and technology. The Recovery Act is accelerating the pace of technical innovation in the energy sector, which can serve as the basis for sustained future economic growth. We're restoring U.S. leadership in science and technology so we can lead the global competition in clean technology. For instance, the Recovery Act included $400 million for a unique program called Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy, or ARPA-E, modeled after the Defense Department's famed DARPA. DARPA is widely credited for inventing the Internet, among other things. ARPA-E will fund high-risk, high-reward energy technologies. As Secretary Chu likes to say, in baseball, ARPA-E is like swinging from the heels. Not every project will succeed, but those that do have the potential to radically transform our energy system. Game-changing research funded through ARPA-E so far includes grid-scale liquid metal batteries that could cut battery costs by 90% while doubling energy density. Direct solar fuels, photosynthetic organisms that produce hydrocarbons instead of carbohydrates, combining CO2, sun, and water to produce ultra-clean gasoline. And super high-efficiency small wind turbines, leveraging advanced aerospace designs and materials to reduce the cost, improve the reliability, and expand the range of wind energy. Taken together, the projects we funded under the Recovery Act and the many oversubscribed opportunities that we have not been able to fund highlight the opportunity for the United States to accelerate clean energy innovation and take a global leadership position in clean energy industries globally. As I mentioned briefly before, DOE also has the important role of managing our nuclear arsenal and cleaning up sites across the country associated with the legacy of our nation's nuclear weapons program. DOE's Office of Environmental Management oversees more than 80 active sites across the country, 17 of which received $6 billion in Recovery Act funding to accelerate ongoing cleanup work. These shovel-ready projects, quite literally, have created or saved more than 12,000 jobs to date, helping to get local economies moving again while eliminating Cold War-era contamination. So to sum it all up, how have we been doing overall? Some more numbers. To date, DOE has selected $31 billion and obligated $25.5 billion of our just under $37 billion in appropriations under the Recovery Act. We've also underwritten $5.6 billion in clean energy tax credits and grants in lieu of tax credits, and identified more than $1 billion in projects that will be financed through loans and borrowing authority. These funds have been matched by over $28 billion in private capital, supporting around $65 billion in projects. As we move into 2010, we're focused on delivering on the President's objectives for the year. Our goal is to reach 100% selection and obligation of projects by September 30th. We're also working with recipients to get projects started and accelerate hiring. We expect that the first half of 2010 will be a period of increased clean energy job creation, reaching 60,000 jobs created and saved as a result of DOE stimulus funds. And what more must be done? The Recovery Act is a down payment, hugely significant, but alone not sufficient to drive the kinds of investments we'll need to reach our goals. To transition into a clean energy economy, we must create a system of incentives to make clean energy the profitable kind of energy. That means putting a price on carbon pollution through comprehensive energy and climate legislation. With such legislation, we'll establish clear targets and stable rules that will allow American industry to confidently scale up clean energy infrastructure and remain competitive in the 21st century. There is real common ground on comprehensive energy and climate legislation. We must overcome our differences and pass such legislation for ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren. We must also work tirelessly in other ways to build on the Recovery Act, seizing opportunities under, for example, highly successful and overscribed programs such as the tax credit for clean energy manufacturing. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act has helped teach a lesson. When times get tough, government is often part of the solution. Today, millions of Americans are in jobs made possible by public servants in Washington who work tirelessly to shape the Recovery Act and make it effective. Millions of Americans are in jobs made possible by public servants in state governments who worked in partnership with federal officials to restore hope for families across the nation. Governors across the political spectrum have joined in public events to celebrate the arrival of Recovery Act funds in their states. This is part of a great American tradition. When our nation faced 25% unemployment in the Great Depression, the federal government stepped in to stabilize the financial system, establish Social Security, and create millions of new jobs. When our nation was fighting the Second World War, the federal government led efforts to retool our factories, summon us to a great cause, and defeat ruthless dictators on two continents. When our soldiers returned home triumphant, the federal government paid for their education under the GI Bill, giving a generation of Americans a chance for a better life. It was the federal government that built the interstate highways on which so many of us depend, the federal government that provides health security to our nation's seniors with Medicare, and the federal government that conducted the research that led to the creation of the Internet. Every day, Americans enjoy these and many other benefits of work done by their federal government. These are Americans like Wendy Van Zandbergen, a single mom from Durant, Oklahoma, who lost her job as a home health care manager when the job market went sour. She sold her house, exhausted her savings, and emptied her retirement plan to stay afloat. Thanks to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, Wendy is now an energy education trainer with a solid and steady job in her community. These are Americans like Dom Ross, who served for 7 years in the U.S. Army, including a tour in Iraq. Back in civilian life, he landed a job making pizzas, but hoped for more. Thanks to the Recovery Act, last year he received training in home weatherization programs and now has a steady long-term position in Southern Colorado. There are Americans like Tim Rozandik, superintendent of the Homedale School District in Idaho. Thanks to the Recovery Act program to make schools more energy efficient, he says, his school district will now save more than $13,000 each year. The Idaho state government estimates that school upgrades will create more than 250 jobs statewide in the next 3 years. And finally, there are Americans like Dave View, president of A123 Systems, a battery manufacturer that started as a spinoff from MIT's labs in 2001 with the help of a $100,000 DOE Small Business Innovation Research Grant. Since then, the company has raised over $350 million in private capital. Today, A123 is using a $249 million Recovery Act grant to build factories in Romulus and Brownstone, Michigan. Thanks to the Recovery Act, A123's first large-scale battery plant will be built in this country, creating jobs here in some of the hardest-hit communities in the United States. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act helped kickstart a sputtering economy and is making investments that will matter for years to come. But even the historic investments under the Recovery Act will not be enough. They're just a down payment. The most powerful engine of innovation and job growth in our country is the private sector. In the months and years ahead, our success will depend upon both our willingness to use the federal government wisely to help all Americans, as we have so often throughout our history, and upon the entrepreneurial zeal and innovative spirit of the American people. Thank you very much. Delighted to answer a few questions.
We have a couple of simple rules here. When identify yourself and put your question in the form of a question, it would be extremely helpful and move things along. Why don't you, we'll start right here.
Bill Murray with Energy Intelligence Group. You mentioned how important the price on carbon would be in terms of pushing forward the clean energy future that the administration has plans for. If we don't get a price on carbon through legislation in the next year, Where does that leave the Obama administration's policy?
I want to speculate on what will or won't happen, but I think the president has made clear, Secretary Chu has made clear, that putting a price on carbon pollution is a priority. And it's called upon Congress to pass legislation and move it forward. This is an issue of both economic competitiveness today and in the future, and we need to put in place the right type of incentives to make sure that American businesses can be competitive over the long term. You know, one of the things I often hear are businesses bemoaning lack of stability in regulatory systems, and businesses have often made the point that once the rules are set, they can plan accordingly. I think the time has come in the United States, the time is now, as the President has said and Secretary Chu has said, the time is now for us to be putting a price on carbon pollution and creating a set of incentives that American businesses can plan on in the years and decades ahead.
Lee Patrick Sullivan, Clean Skies News. In the President's economic report, I believe it was last week or the week before, he mentioned that the overwhelming majority of the stimulus money has yet to be spent. What's the holdup? Is it red tape? Is it permitting? Why hasn't a lot of the money been spent?
I talked a little bit about that in my remarks. I mean, spending this money is required extraordinary mobilization of managerial talent and resources. At the Department of Energy, you know, we brought on board top managers and a first-rate team in order to do it, and I think around the government the same type of thing is happening. So a huge effort is going into spending this money well. By the way, also with unprecedented transparency and unprecedented accountability. I would urge everybody here to go to recovery.gov, www.recovery.gov, if you're interested in kind of more detail on any of the items here. And that recovery.gov explains a lot of what's happening in the Recovery Act implementation sphere. So it's an enormous and big effort. I think the money's already been spent, at unprecedented rates. So, I think it's an enormous credit to the people at, working on this at DOE and elsewhere. The enormous work that's already been done is the type of things I talked about in my speech. In terms of the exact pace, I guess that people have to look at the exact numbers. But it's really an incredible effort that's underway right now.
Hi. Tim Gardner at Reuters. At the start of your remarks, you mentioned Secretary Chu is going to the Middle East. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit why he's going and if he's going to Saudi Arabia and if it's a conference or if he's meeting with individual ministers.
He is going to Saudi Arabia. He's going to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. He has a series of both private meetings and public events, and beyond that, I'll let him speak when he gets to the region.
You said you were going to talk a little bit about the international dimension, but I guess you weren't able to get to it in the talk. Can you say a little bit about how the administration is organizing itself to promote green energy abroad, specifically with respect to both nuclear nonproliferation and climate change goals?
Actually, Frank said I was going to talk about the international dimension. I knew what I was going to talk about, but I'm delighted to answer your question, Chris. This has been a huge priority of ours, and it's one that I've worked on quite a bit personally. A lot to say about it. Personally, I was 5 times in Beijing last year, and when the president was in Beijing in November, he signed a series of agreements on clean energy cooperation across a range of areas, which we're marching forward to implement today. And that's just one example. Prime Minister Singh was here in November, and in the course of that meeting, clean energy was high on the agenda. And in all of these discussions, I think the clean energy stimulus spending happening a variety of different capitals plays in and is highly relevant. The international cooperation is got enormous potential, I believe, to make a big difference on the clean energy front. And among the things we're doing this year on this is that Secretary Chu is going to be hosting a clean energy ministerial. We're just looking right now at exact dates, but he's going to be hosting his counterparts from around the world for a ministerial meeting focused specifically on clean energy. In the nuclear area, which you asked about, the president will be hosting a summit in April, Nuclear Security Summit, and there's tremendous attention on this as well.
Let me take the prerogative of the chair here. So you talked about down payment, and we talked about jumpstart, right? So in the context of, in the absence of a carbon tax or establishing a price for carbon through cap and trade, when you look at deficit spending and the inability to continue, you know, top-down spending, what's the kind of game plan as we get into 2010, 2011? How do you sustain this?
It's a key question, Frank. And I'd point to two things. First, there are programs that we're proposing to extend. And I mentioned one of them in the speech, and that's the, you know, the president has proposed to extend the tax credit for advanced energy manufacturing. And I think that's part of the answer. Another perhaps bigger part of the answer is spurring innovation in the private sector. And that has been a driver of all of the decisions that we've made under the Recovery Act, is recognizing that what we can do with the Recovery Act is spur innovation more broadly. And unless we can make investments that we believe will be sustainable in terms of business models in the private sector, we won't be able to achieve the results that we're all hoping for. So, you know, for example, if you looked in the electric vehicle area, what we're doing is funding a core of activity here in the United States that we believe can be the center of a very vibrant American advanced electric vehicles industry and lots more.
Hi, I'm Alan Tarleton with the U.S. Business and Industry Council. And it's often the case that government is a lot more effective at writing rules than in actually monitoring compliance and actually enforcing them. And in that vein, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the kinds of resources that DOE in particular has been devoting to enforcing the Buy American and various U.S. content rules that have been attached to its efforts, especially regarding green manufacturing and advanced vehicles.
A key point here is that every dollar that is spent under the Recovery Act is going for U.S. job and U.S. job creation, and that as part of any application process, the focus is on what jobs are created in the United States. In terms of specific, I guess, make another point related to the question you just asked on enforcement, because the Department of Energy, in another sphere, we've just launched enforcement efforts that are unprecedented. For the first time, the slightly different than the question you're asking, the Department of Energy is enforcing the Energy Star label and looking at the compliance of appliance manufacturers with the actual claims made in the Energy Star label. You're asking a good question in terms of precise resources on enforcement and follow-up, and we can get back to you on that. But I don't have this at the tip of my tongue.
I'm Joe Dukert, independent energy analyst and also a senior associate in political economy here at CSIS. I have not read your latest book, but I did read Freedom from Oil.
And thank you.
I thought it was a very fine book.
Hope you bought it, too.
Right. Oh, I bought it. I bought it. And so this is not a gotcha question. One of the recommendations of the president in his final speech was to increase gasoline taxes 10 cents a year for 5 years. Now, I wonder if you tried to push that after you came into the administration and whether or not you've given up.
I look forward to your gotcha questions. I mean, that's... Most public officials, I don't want to comment on private conversations, but I would also say in the book I talk about some of the political challenges associated with the proposal you just referred to, and kind of the tension between some of the ideas that emerge from think tank communities and ideas that emerge from the political setting. So I appreciate you reading the book, and I'd go back and read that part of it too. It would be relevant to that.
Thanks. I'm Kate Howard from NRDC. Just a quick question, sort of drilling down beyond what you had asked about the clean tech manufacturing credit. Are there any other credits, for example, like the 1603 grants in lieu of credit, that you guys would like to see extended, or are you simply going to focus more closely on the manufacturing tax credit?
At this point, there's a proposal on the one that I'm, advanced energy manufacturing,
okay.
And that's it. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. Leonard Oberlander, independent consultant.
Hello.
Aside from the job creation that you have described, can you tell us something about what is being done to create, but also to sustain the research and development efforts that are going on at universities and startup endeavors in the private sector to bring to market new technologies, to develop them and bring them to market in today's economy?
It's a great question to close on, because this has really been a priority of, not the priority for Secretary Chu, who comes out of this background and who believes that the United States can transform its R&D energy base, I believe. The Department has advanced a series of proposals in this area, including for so-called hubs for energy innovation. And Secretary Chu has spent a lot of time talking to scientists about this. We have actually a number of other distinguished scientists in senior positions in the administration. Christina Johnson is our undersecretary, who comes out of a distinguished background in electrical engineering. Steve Coonan, who was a dean at Caltech, is another undersecretary at the department. There's an enormous amount of effort in the department going into this across a range of different activities. We're funding, not just under the Recovery Act, but funding in our HUBS program, funding in our basic science program, really to try to revolutionize American, energy R&D. So with that, I want to end by thanking CSIS for both the great idea of doing this and the opportunity to talk to you all. Thanks very much for listening.
If we get Sarah, if you want to come up and sit at the second panel. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, sir. Great, and thank you very much, David. I know it's hard to sort of come in and give all those numbers in a speech, and we're going to try and make those remarks available for everybody after after the fact, as long as they we can get them and post them online, as well as some of the presentations you're going to see in this next panel. Good morning. I'm Sarah Ladislaw. I work in the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS, and I'm really excited about today's event, which is the second in a series that we're running this year called the Opportunity Tipping Point, and you can learn more about it on our website if you'd like. The first event had Jonathan Pershing talking about post-Copenhagen, and today's event is not only to look at sort of the one-year anniversary of the DOE stimulus, U.S. stimulus program, but also to take a broader look at sort of global stimulus efforts, global green stimulus efforts, and also see what's going on around the world, but also ask some critical questions about, as Frank had said, how do you sustain this stimulus effort after the fact? What have been the impacts? How are people spending this money differently? Has it been a success? How do you determine whether it's a success? And I'm really excited about the panel we've been able to put together. Someone came up to me, and I didn't pay them, or they don't work at CSIS, and said, you really have a star-studded panel today, and I completely agree. As a nerdy researcher, these are the kind of people that I want to hear from, and they've done some of the best, most comprehensive, most analytical work looking at questions of global green stimulus, how stimulus is being spent in different parts of the world, and how we all should view, engage sort of the success of these programs. So without further ado, I'm going to get the panel started because we're running a little bit behind time. What we're going to do today is everyone's going to present, and then we're going to ask questions afterwards. So if you could hold your questions till the end, that would be appreciated. And we're going to try and leave as much time for discussion, as I know there's a lot of knowledgeable folks out there who'll have some really good questions. So today, on today's panel, we have the great pleasure of having Nick Robbins, who's the head of the Climate Change Center at HSBC, who's done some of the most comprehensive work that I've seen to date on global green stimulus spending. We also have Ethan Zindler, who's the head of North American Research at Bloomberg New Energy Finance, who's going to talk a little bit more about the impact of stimulus spending on private sector activity, talk about some of the market dynamics in particular and what needs to happen post-stimulus. We've got Julian Wong, who's a senior policy analyst from the Energy and Climate Change Program at the Center for American Progress, who's going to talk to us a little bit more about what we can and don't know about how China is implementing their stimulus program. And then finally, Kevin Book, who's the Managing Director for Research at Clearview Energy Partners, LLC, who's going to ask some of these really sort of analytical deep dive questions about how the stimulus money is being spent and places for improvement and things like that. So without further ado, Nick.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here. What I want to do is really highlight why a international bank and investment research company is interested in the green stimulus. For us last year, we all knew that Copenhagen was happening. I think one of the surprises was the green stimulus phenomenon. We expected a nice big international organization like the OECD to be doing international analysis of the stimulus phenomenon. We found it wasn't, so that's why we tried to do it ourselves. So I just really wanted to sort of talk about sort of 5 points and raise questions for discussion. I think the first and obvious point is normally environmental agendas, environmental spending agendas get put on the back burner. This doesn't seem to have been to happen this time. Our estimates that about $513 billion around the world has been allocated to global green stimulus. So I'll talk a bit about the definitions we use. This is about 15%, we think, of the fiscal stimulus. Importantly, I think this is also aligned with some strategic thinking, particularly coming out of East Asia, where we think about two-thirds of the green stimulus is allocated. This has had real impacts on actual investments. We've heard from David Sandelow, and also investor confidence, and also some lessons about how to leverage private capital, which is a very burning question in the wake of the Copenhagen summit last year. On that, and as David Sandelow, I think, highlighted, the international dimension has been a missing link. For obvious political reasons, stimulus packages have been internally and domestically focused. But one of the issues that we do need to think about is actually how we can also spend public money very effectively internationally to actually leverage private capital. And then for us, as analysts looking ahead, obviously we have the stimulus phenomenon, but also is this going to be followed by a repeat of the sort of boom and bust period we've had in previous policy rounds? Are we going to enter a realm of green austerity as governments try to cut back spending, particularly in the industrialized world? So just to remind us about why I think this is important as an issue, the point of stimulus is to be temporary, is to be targeted, and also to be timely. The question we've been asking is, can this also be transformative? And why are the reasons whereby governments have been thinking about linking the climate change environment, clean energy, and stimulus agenda? One, I think, is around the risk issue. I think we should not forget the issues of systemic risk, and people, I think, have been aware of those issues. Obviously, energy security, energy independence, the job agendas, as we heard, driving the next round of productivity, and also kick-starting the transition to a low-carbon economy. Just to underline, of course, that this is no substitute for long-term climate and clean energy strategy. This is supposed to be a temporary measure. So how do we do our estimates? We use the investment themes designed by the HSBC Climate Change Index. This index has 18 investment themes, looks around the world at the 65,000 stocks that are listed on the world's stock markets, and identifies those that actually do derive revenues from climate change solutions in these four areas: low carbon energy production, so renewables and nuclear in particular, energy efficiency, energy management in buildings, transport and industry, this would include grids, water waste and pollution control, fairly self-evident, and then carbon finance, by far the smallest. Just to underline our results, our estimates, and one of the big issues, I think, for analysts is the lack of transparency in many country programs. Just to link this with some public opinion research that we've been doing. We've been doing this for 3 years now, polling 12,000 people, 1,000 in 12 countries in developed and developing world, just to get their views on the issues of climate change. One question we posed last year, in the fall of last year, was how the world's public views public spending and views public spending on climate change. So about sort of two-thirds in all viewed tackling climate change as about the same or higher priority as a number of sort of very core political issues, which I think was an interesting conclusion from the fall of last year. So the results, I hope you can see those. As I said, about $513 billion allocated, the largest amount in China. That was the first package that really got off the ground, and I hope we'll hear more about that. Also, I'd take note of Korea, and obviously here in the US. One point to underline, the European Union's package at a member state level and at a union level has generally been smaller. This is because, obviously, the European Union has a more automatic welfare system, and many of the renewable and clean energy energy packages are much better established there, so maybe the need for a stimulus, particularly on the green side, is less pronounced. These are our estimates in terms of the percentage of green stimulus using our definitions as part of the total fiscal plan. As you can see, Korea comes out at almost 80%. Their whole package has been designed as the Global Green New Deal launched last January, and the country is passing legislation which will come into force this April, allocating 2% of GNP on their green growth strategy. So a very clear commitment there. China coming in at about a third, and the US at about 12%. Interesting to see that South Africa has also been allocating money in their budget and stimulus package. In terms of where's the money going, the big area is this big area of energy efficiency, and particularly in terms of buildings, in terms of rail, in terms of grid spending. Renewables, I think, we were surprised when we did the figures in terms of when you think of green stimulus, you think of lots of money in renewables. Really, that is coming largely out of the US, but then other low-carbon areas and water infrastructure. So mostly an environmental infrastructure phenomenon. Again, one of the things that I think we've heard today in discussions about the US, but also as a more general phenomenon, is the question of political commitments being made, but actually are these being delivered? And this chart shows our varying estimates through the year, starting in May last year, then August, and then our latest assessment back in November, about the amount of stimulus that has been spent globally. And as you can see, our estimates for 2009 came down from about $135 billion to about $94, which bumped up the stimulus spending for this year, which is obviously going to be the big year of delivery, and then slightly bumped up that for 2011. Obviously, there are very different rules around the world in terms of the allocations and the solidity of allocations, but obviously as spending gets delayed, the risks, particularly in a time of austerity, is this spending maybe gets caught in the retrenchment process. So just to wrap up some of the lessons so far. Firstly, public finance can crowd in private capital. I think it's interesting to see the role of the multilateral development banks in Europe. We've seen the role of the European Investment Bank coming into play. And I think the role of public finance institutions in terms of crowding in private capital is important. And I think that has helped to underpin some of the clean energy investment last year. It has been a national phenomenon. One of the few positive developments, I think, that came out of Copenhagen was the commitment to $30 billion in terms of fast start funding. How can we see that as essentially as a stimulus package for clean energy and low-carbon technologies around the world and use that to leverage 2, 3, 4 times in terms of private capital? Importantly for us as analysts, but I think also for public accountability as well, is transparency, particularly around regular reporting. The US has a very good system, Australia, France, and Canada as well, but many other countries, we don't see the sort of real-time data on disbursements that many analysts, including many business people, will need. We've heard about the issue of operational efficiency, getting the procedures in place to actually disperse quickly, and I think, therefore, we have a fear of delay leading to retrenchment. And finally, this question again, which I'd like to hear your thoughts on as well, is how can we make this smooth transition from stimulus to recovery? Just one example there, the Major Economies Forum, its Technology Action Plan report, which was launched at the time of Copenhagen, was talking about the need to increase public investment around the world in the Major Economies Forum 3 to 6 times to get us onto a low-carbon track. How are we going to be able to do that in a time when public budgets, particularly in the industrialized world, are under severe downward pressure? Many thanks.
Great. Thanks, Nick. And I think we're going to go with Ethan next because you've got a presentation as well. One of the critical questions here we've asked Ethan to address is how exactly stimulus spending impacts sort of the private sector and leverages private sector funding. So he's going to talk a little bit about that.
Hi, and thanks very much. What I'm going to talk a little bit about today is the important role that the private sector is playing in interacting with the stimulus and also how critical the success of the stimulus is on what private market conditions are right now. Just very quickly, for those of you who don't know us, Bloomberg New Energy Finance is a global research firm covering clean energy investment worldwide. These are where our offices are. The firm has been around for 5 years. We were acquired by Bloomberg a couple months ago. And really what we do is track the flow of financing in this sector. Our primary clients are investment banks, venture capital funds, manufacturers in the clean energy sector, a number of government agencies, including the Department of Energy, and really our one and only focus is on clean energy and low-carbon energy technologies. So, you know, 5 years of gathering data and studying this sector, I will try and sum up in basically one slide about what's happening in the clean energy sector at this very moment. In a very rapid period of time, we went from a moment of extraordinary investment and capital availability in this sector to one where suddenly capital has become more constrained. We've not gone all the way back to where we were in 2004, but we're not where we were in 2008 either. We've gone from a period where there was a very low supply of equipment, and that equipment was fairly high priced, to one in which suddenly we've got a very high amount of equipment available and falling prices, particularly in the solar sector. Inevitably, that meant that manufacturers had a lot of power to dictate prices. Now buyers, which in this case means consumers and developers of projects, are in the driver's seat. And we've really gone from a period of sporadic government support for via various kinds of subsidies to a much more concentrated and focused effort on this sector. So right now, we really are in an ongoing, as I say, an ongoing recovery and readjustment to new difficult and changed conditions. And into this comes the stimulus package, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But in terms of, again, the sector, you know, tracking the money, this is one of the things that we, you know, really do sort of our bread and butter is, as you can see, you've seen this spectacular run-up from back in 2004 from about $36 billion all the way up to $155 billion in 2008, and then a bit of a drop-off in 2009. This year, we actually do expect the money to come back in, hit about $180 to $200 billion on the year. That is with the very large caveat that we continue to have economic recovery and growth. We're not macroeconomic forecasters, so to some degree that goes out the window if we do a double-dip recession here. But assuming we continue to come back, we think we'll see growth this year. Now, one of the things that I think, you know, an important point to be made about the stimulus, and I'm going to talk about it a lot here, is that it's probably the most important supply-side policy ever aimed at growing clean energy capacity in the United States. It is incredibly generous in the amount of money that it's going into the sector. But it has arrived at a moment of sudden oversupply in the marketplace. If right here, this is very recently some research that we put out, which you can see that suddenly in the U.S., after years of being undersupplied with wind turbines, is about to enter into a period of significant oversupply. The bars demonstrate the amount of supplied, thousands of megawatts of supplied turbines. The lines indicate the demand that we project out. We have both a bull and a bear scenario over the next couple of years, but you'll notice that even in our bullish scenario, the amount of turbines that are going to be built in the United States is more than are going to be needed here in the U.S. So those things have to find a home someplace. And turbine makers are going to either try and send them to South America where there's growing interest or other markets, or they're going to hope that here in the U.S. we start to have more demand. And at the same time, that's been coupled with a capital undersupply suddenly. One of the things that we noted as we broke the numbers down this year was that for the first, you know, we grouped the world into three segments. There's Europe, Middle East, and Africa, EMEA. There's the Americas, and there's the Asia and Oceania region. And as you can see, this was really the first year that the Asia region jumped ahead of the Americas region in terms of investment in clean energy. So we've seen a drop-off in available capital in the U.S., and this covers South America as well, but most of this money has been up here that took place last year. So suddenly we have oversupply of equipment and an undersupply of capital, and in comes the stimulus. In terms of where renewables, and this is one last piece of the puzzle here, in terms of where renewables fit within compared to conventional power, I think it's important to remember that they are still much more expensive on an unsubsidized basis than coal and natural gas. We are analysts of the industry. We're not, you know, promoters of the industry. So I think it's important to take stock of this. One thing we do every quarter is we look at the so-called levelized cost of energy, which is how much a typical contract that a developer has to sign with a utility to make a 10% return on investment on a project. And one of the things that we've noted, and as you look through the list here, you'll see coal and natural gas down near the bottom of the list. You can see the various clean energy technologies stacked up all the way up. One thing that we've noticed is that while equipment prices have been coming down very nicely, the cost of capital has not been coming down, or it's been going up in a number of cases. And so these two things offset each other, and you've not seen a dramatic decrease in the levelized cost of energy for developers. So again, about the ARRA, as I said, most important federal clean energy legislation in history. By our calculation, $66, $67 billion for DOE, DOD, GSA, Treasury money. We only are counting clean energy. We're not counting rail. We're not counting water, just clean energy. And I think it's important, though, to note that many of these components of the money getting actually out the door are contingent on the private sector. So you have grants that are contingent on parties raising some independent money for their project. You've got loan guarantees where a bank has to come in and provide some of the debt as well. You've got tax credits where sometimes third-party tax equity investors are needed. And so thus, the success is contingent on private fundraising conditions. In this case, for tech firms, it's venture capital availability. For companies that do manufacturing, it's typically public market funds, such as stock exchange raises via IPOs and other things like that. And for projects, it's debt capital. And I would say there's been some successes to date, but there's still plenty left to be proven here. Our calculations on how much money's gone out the door, David mentioned $31 billion is what we say has been allocated, leaving about another $35 billion left to go in terms of allocation. But our view is that, our clients want to know how much money literally has hit the street. It's nice that you could talk about how it's been allocated and how maybe you've assigned it to go to this state or that state, but how much money has actually gone into the marketplace? Our estimate is somewhere in the range of no more than $5 to $10 billion has actually gone into the marketplace at this point. Now, that's not a criticism. I think, in many senses, the DOE has moved at sort of light speed by government standards to get this money out the door. But the reality of it is, in terms of how much money is in the market and circulating, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 10. But the impact the stimulus has been very dramatic and very positive. I don't mean to underplay that, but in terms of actual dollars, it's not as big as some of the numbers we may have heard so far. Quickly, a couple of sort of success stories, in terms of the way I think that this was all supposed to work. Solyndra is a company based in California. They make long cylindrical PV modules. They raised $600 million in 2008, and then in 2009 they were offered the DOE's first loan guarantee. Having finalized that about 6 months later, they raised about $200 million more in private equity, which was based on the fact that they'd been able to get this loan guarantee. And then now they're shooting for an IPO, I believe, on NASDAQ for $300 million. So this is a case where they've leveraged that government support. They got some private capital, and now they're going to go for some public capital. And this is sort of the virtuous circle, as it, I think, is supposed to be working. Similar story that David told about A123 Systems. I won't go through it since he talked about it in great detail. But, basically, that's another very good example of where this has played very well. And, again, I guess I would call this sort of the virtuous Ferris wheel or circle or lollipop of DOE involvement in the electric vehicle sector. And I only put this up to sort of highlight the fact that we focus very much on the money going out the door from DOE, but money goes out the door from DOE, and then one company makes an investment in another company, or one company starts and signs a supply contract with another company. So what you can see here are these various dotted lines to the center of the pinwheel. Is money either dispersed or promised to one of these various companies in the electric vehicle sector? And then on the outside, you see Treasury and its support for GM, but you also see a $370 million IPO for A123 Systems. You see $92 million that Fisker Automotive, an electric vehicle maker, raised. And then you see a number of these sort of white arrows, which are the supply agreements and investments that have taken place between these various companies. So there's an ecosystem of electric vehicle companies out there, battery makers, control systems, and others, and the DOE is playing a critical role in supporting them, although not always directly in the way that gets documented through stimulus grants. And finally, just to reiterate some of the points I think I've sort of made along the way, in the most basic sense, renewables are not competitive yet with fossil fuels. Solar is moving very quickly in that direction, and we predict maybe as soon as a year from now it will be there in some markets. It's really contingent on electricity prices and a number of other factors. But they're not there yet. And insofar as they're not there yet, you have to find a way to sort of bridge the gap if that is your long-term goal. The ARRA was entirely focused on the supply of clean energy goods and projects. This is not a criticism. It's just the political realities was that this is where money was intended to come in. But it is now arriving and being dispersed in an oversupplied marketplace in which supply-side policies really are only going to be so useful. And so what could the ARRA's impact? Well, obviously, if the economy suddenly comes roaring back to life and a lot more capital is available, then these companies that need to take advantage of their grants by raising money from venture capital are going to have more capital available. Some of the bigger guys who need to raise money to build their manufacturing plants are going to be able to IPO. All kinds of good things are going to happen if the economy keeps rebounding. If that doesn't happen, which is a distinct possibility, or even if it does happen, the other thing that the government could do and probably should do, in our view, if they really want to sort of set this market on fire, is to create a demand-side policy that supports the clean energy sector. And there was some talk of carbon cap and trade. Obviously, that would be helpful to the sector, but our view is much more helpful would be a national renewable electricity standard, which Congress is, again, contemplating at this moment, and we can certainly talk more about. But if you couple the very strong supply-side policies that you've had with a significant demand-side policy, again, I think you would see very, very strong growth in the U.S., and you would make major strides towards that clean energy economy that the administration talks so much about. But until those two things happen, you're going to have some problems along the way. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ethan. Next, we've asked Julian to come in and ask answer sort of the real easy question, which is what's going on in China? China has a really very large stimulus program, and everyone up here has sort of been able to write about it at some point, talking about what they do know and don't know. We asked Julian to really kind of dig in and figure out what we are able to know, not able to know, about how China is spending their green stimulus, how they define it, what their priorities are, things like that. And having done some research in the area, this is not an easy question to answer. So we're really looking forward to what you have to say, Julian.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Sarah, for hosting this event, inviting me to share these remarks, and thanks to CSIS as well. So I think what I'm going to do today is talk about, first lay out what we do know about China's stimulus package and what we do know about the green components of it. And then sort of try to, I will sort of present the argument that, you know, it's really hard to, I guess the first caveat is that there isn't a recovery.gov.cn website that really tracks in a transparent manner what's going on. I wish there were. So that's the biggest challenge, is trying to figure out, as Ethan said, what money is hitting the street in China, both in the terms of the broader stimulus package and also in terms of the green components. I will argue that the stimulus package is not as green as many press reports have covered it, but on the one hand. But on the other hand, there's a lot of things going on outside the November 08 fiscal stimulus package. There's a lot of things going on in monetary stimulus that are green. So on one hand, it's not as green as it looks, but on the other hand, if you look at a bigger picture, it is greener. So, and then just sort of like bring it back to the home, bring it back to the U.S. And sort of like draw a few lessons that we can learn and take back. But I think the foremost important thing to realize is that, make no mistake about it, China is going into clean energy in a major way. It's just that it's doing it in a variety of mechanisms that are difficult to track. So what do we know about the stimulus package in China? The fiscal stimulus package was announced in November of 08. It was $586 billion. But the thing to note is that the central government only committed to fund about 27% of that $586 billion. The assumption was that the remainder would be funded by subnational governments, provincial governments, municipal governments, along with the private sector. So really, the commitment from the central government is a lot smaller than the large headline number would suggest. And the OECD suggests that actually the private sector component of it is especially large, as probably two-thirds of it. And what's interesting about that is these companies are not investing and contributing to stimulus through retained earnings, but rather it's through bank lending, so loans that they take out from banks. So this is where the monetary policy is important. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a bit. Another interesting development over the course of the year was the change in allocations. So initially, there are three potential components that are potentially green. And the first is sustainable development. There was a part called sustainable development where the initial allocation was 9% of this $586 billion. In March of 2009, that got reduced to 5%. And then there's this infrastructure part, which is probably the biggest component of the whole Chinese stimulus package. And the initial allocation was 45%, and that got reduced slightly to 38% in March of 2009. And then there's a third component, which is a little more cryptic. It's called technology advances and industry restructuring. So to the extent that there's innovation in clean energy technologies, energy efficiency, to the extent that this stimulus money affects a structural industry restructuring from heavy industry to light industry, one could consider that green stimulus. But it's really hard to unpack and know where the money is going. But the initial allocation for that in November 2008 was 4%, and that got increased more than doubled to 9% in March of 2009. A third thing to mention about what we know about the stimulus package is that there's been some debate about how much of this $586 billion truly represents new stimulus programs versus programs that existed but were just repackaged by the central government to provide a market signal that the government was taking the recession seriously. I think the broader point is that if you want to think about it, really, if you think about China's trajectory in its economic growth, wouldn't we say that it's done a 30-year stimulus plan since 1979, since it's decided to open up its economy? I think what we've seen in clean energy, too, is it's not a result of just the stimulus package alone. It is a result of a long-term investment plan. You know, they have a medium to long-term plan that stretches to 2020, and from what I understand, the newly formed National Energy Commission is in the process of rethinking and extending that long-term goal to 2030. So let's dig a little deeper into these few components that I talked about. Infrastructure is the biggest portion, and when we talk about infrastructure, what this includes is everything from highway construction to grid construction, grid build-outs, which is essential if you're talking about delivering clean energy electrons from remote sources to the cities. And China happens to lead the world in terms of ultra-high voltage technology. And so that's something to know. It also includes things like rail, which you could subdivide in terms of freight rail or high-speed rail. And it's such an amazing story in terms of rail in China. China is about to spend about a projected $300 billion till 2020 to really build out essentially the world's largest network of high-speed rail. And already, several phases of these high-speed rail infrastructure have opened, and if anyone has had the opportunity to take them, they're truly state-of-the-art. But at the same time, it also includes freight rail. So, a lot of that is really dedicated to transporting coal from place to place. So, squaring the high-speed rail, which is mass transit, which one can certainly think of as green, versus freight rail that transports coal. How do you square that? And no one really has the numbers to how that is divvied up. And then money is also spent in the sustainable development part to things like energy conservation, which is important because energy efficiency is a major push of the government in terms of its energy policy. It's also spent on waste disposal, waste management, and also spent on water efficiency, water-saving conservation. And finally, ecological restoration, things like soil rehabilitation, reforestry programs, and such. The notable thing is that no money has been allocated to renewable energy or renewable energy projects, at least in the fiscal stimulus. And I think the answer to that is that a lot of the funding for renewable energy projects is really coming from the banks. And this is where I talked about earlier that, you know, apart from this fiscal stimulus, there's this whole other world of monetary stimulus, bank lending stimulus. And the size of that is actually quite large indeed. By some estimates, in 2009, new loans totaled to $1.5 trillion, which is truly, remarkable, considering that the GDP of China was about $4.5 trillion, so one-third. And that really has been, it's been quite a present topic in Chinese economic policy as of late. There's been a lot of concerns that we're entering a potentially dangerous inflationary period, and that has prompted the central bank to increase reserve ratios and to sort of tighten up monetary policies a bit. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in terms of clean energy financing, and especially in terms of those large-scale wind projects and solar projects. And I think, so I sort of entered a section where, I sort of titled here, "All That Glitters Is Not Green." And so I alluded to some of this earlier, just in terms of how do you square, how do you really break down the real investments, like what's green and what's not. And certainly one can think of green investments, like I said, as an essential part of a clean energy economy. But, whether it's grid, whether it's rail, they all take enormous amounts of cement and steel. And if you really want to do a true life cycle accounting of the kind of fixed asset investments that is being put into place, and really accounting for the embedded carbon, I think you get a slightly different picture. So what I'm suggesting is that to take into account the investments that are overtly labeled as green versus those that are not. And make no mistake about it, this has been a lot of investments. Recall this, the earthquakes in Sichuan 2 years ago, one quarter of the $586 billion was allocated to rebuilding Sichuan. And so that's a lot of building reconstruction. And the fact of the matter is that I would be surprised if any significant proportion of those projects would survive the sort of rigorous environmental impact assessments that the government has promised it would undertake. In fact, this has been a tussle. In fact, the Ministry of Environmental Protection came out early in the stimulus process saying that we won't approve projects that are high in pollution and high in energy consumption. But when the numbers shaked out, they were essentially only turning down one-tenth of large-scale infrastructure projects. And the fact of the matter is heavy industry, particularly steel and cement industries, benefited a lot from the stimulus package in a way that suggests that really the environmental ministry's power to enforce its environmental impact assessments was limited, or maybe a decision was made internally to sort of tone that process down a little bit. And like I said, the investments in the highways. The other story is that China is now the largest auto market in the world, and it's really only getting started, which is the scary thing. And for all we talk about the ability of developing countries to leapfrog the West in developing a new carbon future, I think what we're seeing in China suggests that there's a lot more work to be done, because at least when it comes to transportation, it is repeating the mistakes of the West. And that is something that, quite frankly, planners will have grappled with and continue to grapple with in terms of their energy policy. And then I want to talk a little bit about the bank financing. And really, this is one of the distinguishing features of China's stimulus compared to U.S., whereas in the U.S., what happened in the wake of the crisis that no banks were willing to lend because of the unique political structure of China and because all the major banks are owned by the government, when the government decided to intervene in the economy, it really opened the spigots for financing. And so it became basically a more important element of China's stimulus than was the announced fiscal stimulus. But I don't want to sound to be too down on China's sort of like green agenda, because in actual fact, they are undertaking a very profound and committed undertaking to to develop a clean energy industry. It is, you know, it's going to be a pillar industry, named as a pillar industry for the next five-year plan. They see it as a strategic industry, not just in terms of economic growth and technology development, but certainly for national security and energy security reasons. You know, there's been a lot written about the really lofty renewable energy and energy efficiency targets in China. I won't talk about that, but surely all that is driving, sending the right market signals to industry and to investors, and that is driving a lot of growth in the sector. And most recently, of course, as a result of the Copenhagen process, China committed to a 40 to 45% reduction in carbon emissions as a per unit of economic output. An analysis by Renmin University, which is one of the more prominent universities in China, suggested that to meet that goal, China would have to invest $30 billion per year for the next 10 years. And, you know, China is really investing across the whole value chain of the energy industry. So it's not just, whereas we tend to think that China's prowess in the clean energy space is as a result of the manufacturing, you know, the ability to manufacture at such a rapid rate and productive rate. While that is true, China realizes that that alone won't get fully develop the clean energy industry. So as a result, they're investing a lot in deployment, setting the standards that would send the right signals to the market, and also increasingly they're investing in the innovation aspect of it, something that is not a traditional strength of the history of science and technology in modern China, at least. And so they have national programs called the 863 program, the 973 program, where the energy sector, particularly new and renewable energy, is a target industry for development. And there was a New Scientist article a few weeks ago that sort of highlighted China's new role in new emphasis in science and technology, talking about how now that Chinese basically leads the world in terms of number of scientific journal articles published, and increasingly as well, the number of patents being filed is on the rise as well. So another aspect of a couple of final points. You know, it's been clear through, particularly through the lending activities from the banks, you know, a majority of this lending just goes to state-owned enterprises, and they are another major vehicle of China's clean energy story. And it's something that is unique to China and a lot of East Asian economies. One notable entity worth pointing out is called the China Energy Conservation Investment Corporation, or CESIC. This is a company, a state-owned company, that has about 180 subsidiaries and more than 11,000 employees. And they invest in across the full range of clean energy technologies and energy efficiency technologies. And more recently, they're going really big on solar. They're partnering with SunTech, which is by now the world's largest solar manufacturer. It's a Chinese company, to build projects across China. And also now they're venturing to seek projects in Europe. So they're going global in a big way. Looking forward to the 12-5-year plan and beyond, there's talk of a new package, particularly for new energy and renewable energy. Media reports last year suggested a 10-year plan of investments of $440 billion to $660 billion. Now, that hasn't quite transpired for reasons that no one is quite sure. I suspect that a lot of this, the shakeout of the recession and the implementation of stimulus process probably painted or provided some reason for caution in terms of announcing a package of that nature. But I expect that somewhere within the next year, we would expect new renewable energy targets and a strategy going forward for the next two decades, really, on how China will chart its course in clean energy. To summarize, I think, and to conclude, I think what we know about China's fiscal stimulus package is that, it is helpful in providing a jump start to certain sustainable development sectors, but because there are competing priorities, the fiscal stimulus package by itself may have limited effect. I think what's more interesting in China's case is its long-term sustained policy, both in terms of its monetary policy, but also in terms of its strategic long-term development plans. And, you know, I think the lesson in this case for the U.S. is pretty clear, as the Assistant Secretary stated earlier. You know, ARA provides a good jump start in green development in the United States, but it doesn't take us to the promised land, and I think we see that borne out in China as well. And what we need in the U.S. is a more comprehensive approach rather than just two-year temporary measures, and to get the cost of production correct. And in this case, it means, you know, among other things, putting a price on carbon in the United States. So with that, I thank you for your time, and I look forward to questions later on.
Thanks, Julian. Our final speaker is Kevin Book, and Kevin's got the fun job of coming up. We asked him to talk a little bit about, so when you think about the stimulus and how it's been laid out as part of this grand strategy for starting a sort of Green New Deal, green energy revolution, how do we gauge success for a lot of these disparate policies, and are there sort of inherent contradictions within not only the strategies themselves, but the implementation and some of the programs that we've seen thus far? So, Kevin, it's up to you.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, CSIS, for having me. I guess as batting cleanup, part of the job is to ask questions about the first four presenters, and I want to defer to, I think, an extraordinary breadth of material. I'm going to focus essentially on three challenges: trade implications associated with a deleveraging world. I'm going to talk about efficiency as the enemy of that which is clean and green. And a little bit about maybe a spoiler for clean and green investment known as nuclear power. Clearview Energy Partners is a research and consulting firm. We don't look at everything. There are firms that do that very well, several of them represented here on this panel. We look at the things that tend to be game changers. And so the nature of this presentation will follow from that. The OECD stimulus programs basically break down to spending tomorrow's money on yesterday's factories for today's workers. And so this brings us to something of a protectionist problem. Generally speaking, though, stimulus programs are effective. I'm sure I surprise no one when I say that there's a very strong positive correlation between jobs and GDP. Yes, that's right. Especially here in the U.S., it's almost perfect. And so if you look at what the jobs numbers implied about GDP in third quarter, they implied a 0.4% gain. It was 2.2%. In fourth quarter, negative 0.2%. Loss, and it was 5.7% positive. Stimulus works. Clearly, it may not stimulate jobs, and there's an implication. The real question is whether or not these sorts of protectionist outgrowths of spending on your own economy block trade that might long-term be a road to faster recovery. And we're not there yet, so this is sort of a look ahead, certainly not a prediction so much as a what-if. In the post-Copenhagen carbon compliance world, there is a question. If global federalism didn't deliver us into a post-Kyoto single treaty world, is trade and tariff-based compliance where we're going to go? Are we going to tax other countries' stuff? Are we going to penalize other countries for the way they behave by taxing non-energy stuff? Big question. The lack of access to credit has affected the energy end user in a way that I think isn't well appreciated yet. The demand recovery here in the U.S., if you look at this recovery, and we're looking at jobs now relative to energy, is about 15% flatter. So the number of BTUs consumed on average per new job recovered in the economy, 15% flatter than the last recovery. Why? Our hypothesis is that the end user of energy in this country, in the OECD in general, is having a harder time borrowing. It's making it harder to use more energy discretionarily. So what you have in this protectionist question is nations are now competing for a smaller global market, at least temporarily, and a less fulfilling pie if the curve grows. So what can we see? Let's end theory. The ITCs in this country are for an origin-agnostic solar product. The PTCs are for origin-agnostic wind products. But you heard today David Sandilow talk about extending the manufacturing credit for stuff that's made here. Is this a bellwether of perhaps policy changes to come? $2 billion of conventional renewable spending, which was origin agnostic, was devoted to U.S. automakers in the Clunkers program. Again, it's not yet clear whether we are decisively changing anything, whether it's a blip or a trend, but it could be an early sign. The next spoiler I promised was efficiency the enemy. And I don't want to be cavalier about this because there are some well-demonstrated efficiency gains in global performance that we will never get to here in the United States. Germany's reduced the energy, the electricity demand in buildings from 150 kilowatt hours per square meter per year to 30. It's not likely that Americans and in our building stock, our lifestyles will ever get there. On the other hand, when you look at what the market size looks like, power demand is likely to recover and grow if more slowly. Fuels are likely in the OECD to flatten, and here in the U.S., CAFE standards could make them decline. So this is where you get into some of the conflicts of your efficiency gains and your new green technologies. And I think Ethan put it very well. There's a significant oversupply because the government bought a lot of stuff that the private market wasn't, and it's now out there. That capacity exists. So what does it look like if demand is weaker than expected? Natural gas is the first thing I think that provides some context. Fracking here and in Europe could potentially bring not only an abundance of local gas but also extra LNG, and gas prices could stay low for a long time. Obviously, that will have impacts potentially on the profitability on the demand side of these green investments without a carbon price. Power demand fell 3.76% in 08. It's estimated about 1.25% last year. Electric power margins are not a driver necessarily for some of these higher priced read green investments. So again, the environment into which, and then I think Ethan said it very aptly, into which the supply has been brought is one of weaker demand naturally. And here's the bomb waiting to go off. And it's actually, I think, one of the greatest success stories of the stimulus package. There is a genuine market failure in low-income homes. They don't need, you know, motion-sensing lights. They don't need programmable thermostats. They know where the light switch is, and they know where the thermostat is. They've been off all year. What they need is insulation in the walls. Okay, well, what happens if you insulate buildings that never would have been insulated as a function of economic demand response? You shift the curve down a little bit. And so it might not be a lot, but if we get 650,000 homes, which is more than our estimate, you could destroy as much as 1% of electric power demand permanently here in the U.S. Again, it's a good thing, but it makes it harder to be green. The Homestar program that's been discussed, $6 billion in spend this year, might move a lot faster than the energy offices at the state level, which are still choking on a massive influx of new dollars. We think that money gets out eventually. Homestar could ride on top of that another 1%, 1.5%. Let's talk about CAFE standards. Another success, not necessarily explicitly linked to the stimulus package, but certainly supported it in the long term by electric vehicles investments. It's just that if you have a 40-mile-per-gallon car, the cost case for an electric vehicle at today's technology levels, today's subsidy levels, isn't there. You come up $3,000 short over a 7-year vehicle life at $80 oil. On the other hand, if you have a 20-mile-per-gallon car, a battery-powered electric vehicle with a $7,500 subsidy, you're $2,000 ahead at the end of the whole thing. This is one of the challenges. As we make the fleet more efficient, we're raising the bar for competition from some of these portfolio-shifting electric vehicles. Renewable fuel standards, again, not explicitly stimulus, but something to think about. New ethanol replaces 8.5% of gasoline demand in 2020 by our numbers. If all the advanced biofuels come from biodiesel, it's about another 9% of diesel demand in 2020. And taking a very small Pickens plan projection, so wake up, America. We're not going all the way to every truck. It's not going to happen. Okay, if it were just half of 18-wheelers that move point to point and have relatively defined refueling locations, we're talking about 20% of distillate demand. Okay, so first of all, it's bad to be a refiner, but that's not what we're here to talk about. The question is, what does it mean for the green stimulus in this context where you have now got a manufacturing problem? 3 parts gasoline, 2 parts middle distillates, and 1 part products come out of your refinery, and you've just cut the 3 part by about 10% and the 2 part by about 30%. You're already awash in distillate fuels. Now you have even more. Globally, not just here in the U.S., as they proliferate through the world, do they undermine some of the cost case for electric vehicles? Last one, renewable portfolio standards. If you keep coal constant, which is what the Waxman-Markey bill effectively said to do over 10 years, and you allow renewables to cut into the generation mix when it's not growing, you're displacing something. On a one-to-one displacement for gas, you could change the peak gas demand, it was about 7 TCF in 2007, to as little as 5.5 TCF in 2020, if you got everything that the Waxman market went for and you replaced all gas with renewables, which isn't real, or about 6.5 TCF in the Senate bill. This is a decline, and the question is this the greenest outcome you might get? And again, when we go back to the broader question of carbon pricing and demand drivers, which I think is still very much the elephant in the room, here's the deal. If green replaces gas one-to-one and coal stays burning, then emissions are up, by our models, about 2.3% in 2020 versus 2012, and about 13% in 2030 versus 2012. Again, theoretical extreme. If gas comes in with green and displaces everything else, so RPSs come true on a state level or a national level, they're almost the same number, and gas fills up the incremental power demand, we're flat versus 2012 in 2020, and we're up about 6% in 2030 on emissions. So interesting question with gas. Last thing, and this is very short. Yesterday, the president announced $8 billion in nuclear power loan guarantees, and I think everyone should be asking the question, is this where clean goes? Yesterday, Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd said, no, not here. In Germany, they are mothballing 30% of their generating fleet, which is clean and nuclear-powered, 17 reactors. If that changes, and German sentiment changes, perhaps it changes everywhere, the question is, if you have an abundance of available nuclear power, microgeneration, small reactors, whatever it might be, does it displace the economic case even with demand supports for renewable power? Will the story change? We are seeing already equity subsidy fatigue in countries like Germany and Spain who've paid out an awful lot. We have now just, the numbers we got this morning in our stimulus, an implied $2.3 billion spent in grants, tax credits as grants so far. Okay, that's a lot of money. It's not Germany or Spain a lot, but it's a lot. Are we moving towards a world where we look at debt subsidies, loan guarantees, as a way to sort of insulate the politicians who are making the choice, but also the governments themselves from the perception that they are merely spending on something rather than investing in something. To close, green stimulus, however you quantify it, and I learned a lot today. I mean, these numbers are spectacular no matter how you slice them, no matter how precisely you slice them, and trying to divine what the China's natural resources department decides to tell you and figure out what it really means is an almost impossible task. Julian, you have my utmost respect. Globally trying to figure out all these stimulus programs, Nick has done a tremendous job, and Ethan has quantified, I think, beyond the ken of any of his competitors, exactly what we're talking about here in total spend. The question is, does any of this work if you have demand conditions that because of either efficiency, an abundance of natural gas, policy choice to back nuclear power, undermine this wonderful new supply that's been created? I don't know the answer, but I look forward to comments that might produce it. Thanks.
Great. Well, see, I told you that was the fun job. We have got about a half hour left for questions, and while you all think of your questions, I just want to remind you of the ground rules that Frank had outlined at the beginning, which is please wait for the microphone. Please state your name and affiliation, and please, if you could put your question in the form of a question, we'd really appreciate it. One of the things that we did in advance of this session was took a lot of the really excellent work that these folks have done and tried to put together a piece that tried to answer some of the questions about, you know, how is the stimulus being spent, where is it being spent, how do you gauge success, and what does this mean for the prospects of sort of a new Green Deal? And so it's a publication that'll be available on our website as well. But you know, in light of us sort of asking some of those questions and all the great information that's been presented today, I did want to sort of turn to the panelists and first ask, you know, for those of you who've looked at sort of green stimulus programs in many different countries, are there other countries that have particularly good examples, in your view, of how to run one of these programs? Whether, you know, I know different countries have to kind of craft them to suit their own needs, but are there success stories, not in the case of particular companies, but in the case of particular programs that you'd care to highlight as sort of standing out in your mind? And in addition, if you have anything that you'd like to respond to that some of your colleagues might have made in their presentations, maybe we could open up with some of that. So to anyone that wants to take a first shot? Nobody spent stimulus money. Kevin?
I think the only thing I would highlight is in Austin, Texas, which I think may be another country, at least within Texas it is, there are programs that municipally scrap appliances when they're recycled, preventing what we refer to colloquially as the beer fridge effect. You buy a refrigerator that's 50% more efficient than the one you've got and put it in the garage as a beer fridge, and now you're doing 150 basis points or 150% power demand instead of 50. There are programs, and I think the important part of, if we talk HomeStar, we talk about some of the future stimulus measures that are being discussed, to do what the Cash for Clunkers program did, to do what some of the European programs have done with appliances, and to actually force the scrapping of the inefficient capital stock and really move forward not only consumer demand, which is clearly the stimulus part, but the green part, because otherwise you just have a lot of beer fridges.
Well, Sarah, I guess to answer your question, particularly with respect to China, it's a harder sell, I guess. I think the lack of transparency makes it really difficult to really determine how effectively it's being managed. In China, like the U.S., there is a Cash for Clunkers program in China, I think it's a little tricky to see whether that has a positive environmental effect, because I think all it's really doing is really stimulating an already rapidly growing auto sector. And similarly, they have an appliance program, which I guess could be conceivably green, but in reality, they are subsidizing a lot of rural communities to purchase electric appliances which they otherwise would not be able to afford. It's not a bad thing from a development point of view, but it does basically, I think, the net effects to ramp up energy demand, which is something they would have to deal with as well.
I mean, just a few quick points. I mean, I think one of the countries to watch and the country we'd like to learn a lot more about is South Korea. And I think it sort of speaks to the fact of how stimulus fits with countries' wider strategies. It does appear that country is committed to seeing green in a variety of interpretations as the next phase of development. They are committing to allocate 2% of GNP to that. I think we're going to hear a lot more about Korea this year. It's the chair of the G20 in the second half of this year. And one of the things that I think caught our attention is part of that package, the Green Growth Package, was clear targets for ramping up their share of the global export market of environmental technologies. So this is clearly not just an environmental objective. I mean, just I think to build on what Julian was saying as well, I mean, our estimates, and we've been trying to be quite conservative, is that 15% of the fiscal stimulus around the world can be classified as linked to our climate change themes. That means 85% isn't. So that's potentially 85%, which is neutral or indeed negative in terms of achieving climate change objectives. We need to realize that's the big amount of money there. And I think also, I mean, I think what we've heard from Kevin is interesting, is in a sense really thinking about what is it we're talking about here? Because if we're just talking about renewables, that's one thing. If we think about low carbon investment, that's another. And I think one of the things we're certainly struggling with is actually the implications of peak demand in the OECD for both fuels and power, which seems now to be a reality, both driven by core macroeconomic issues, but also by efficiency programs. And if we have peaked in demand for fuels and power, which it looks like we have, then clearly that has quite profound implications for the build-out of any form of new supply.
I guess I'll very quickly just say that Germany, this isn't explicitly a stimulus program, but their feed-in tariff helped build a solar industry there very rapidly. Now, there's clearly been some downsides to that. They're basically getting badly undercut by the Chinese, who've come along with newer plants and are producing at lower cost. So that's the bad, you know, it's sort of the good news, bad news story. If we were trying to replicate that model here in the United States, you run that same risk potentially, although the good news is we're that much closer to, for instance, solar becoming grid competitive, I mean, or cost competitive. So basically Germany carried the ball, you know, for the first 90, you know, eight, whatever number of yards, but, you know, now the U.S. could carry the ball the next 15, 20 yards across the goal line as this technology improves. So we're in a different sort of position of the technology development for solar, and, you know, whether it's a feed-in tariff or some other kind of demand-style policy in the U.S., I think it could help the U.S. get across that line so that you wouldn't just enjoy that 2 to 3 year, 5 year bump or whatever it is, but a long-term bump once this stuff truly becomes competitive.
Lars Friberg, Office of Science and Technologies, Embassy of Sweden. Nick might be able to give more detail on this, but I know in the UK there's a law that bans building of new big coal power plants. And I was wondering if Ethan or Kevin could give an idea of how would that impact this kind of game changing on trying to get renewables online if you can't do it through carbon taxes or emission trading.
I guess I'm not a lawyer, I won't get too legalistic, but I guess my view is that there's not been a law per se that outright bans new coal plants in the U.S., but there has been the sort of conventional wisdom of the past several years that carbon caps were coming, and therefore, if you wanted to build a new coal plant and you wanted to run the numbers on it, there was a pretty big gaping hole in your spreadsheet where you would have to try and figure out what the cost of emitting was going to be under this new cap and trade system, and that was de facto preventing a lot of coal development. Now, whether that will continue to play that role now that Congress has failed to pass the cap and trade last year and will fail this year, I don't know. But to some degree, law or no law, I think the sort of perception and the uncertainty surrounding building coal had been stunting the growth of the coal industry in the U.S. Kevin may have a different take on that.
To be sure, the financial deterrence is real. No one buys unlimited liability when they buy a debt security. And there's a de facto problem with the Public Utilities Commission, too, where they're not willing to take the ratepayers' money and put it behind something unquantifiable. There are, in fact, some legal changes, though, that are coming that they're not exactly bans on coal-fired power, but they're getting closer. They're the things that are related in supporting to coal-fired power, including the most inexpensive ways of getting compliance coal, for example, mountaintop mining. Cheap removal for a lot of the existing plants. Building new plants is a challenge on the East Coast anyway, and it's really in less space-constrained areas where it's more of an option. The potential ban on emissions of sulfur dioxide above 60 parts per million for more than an hour is a significant deterrent to all but the most high-technology new coal plants. And this regulatory environment really, again, it hasn't stopped anything cold. I guess the broader question is, if you look at the behavior of U.S. coal producers, they're beginning to think in many ways like the wind producers here in the U.S. are, which is that they're going to service the export demand of a faster-growing power market somewhere else. And so if there was a place that law might need to take place, take effect, it probably would be in the Far Eastern developing economies.
Lou Pularisi, Energy Policy Research Foundation. I found Kevin's remarks very interesting. I want to ask Ethan and Nick, how you're advising your clients on a certain kind of risk. You know, the Iraqis just have auctioned off 60 billion barrels of crude oil, which is a colossal amount of oil. The shale gas revolution is going to give us lower gas prices. So we could enter an era in which we're on the lower range of oil prices in terms of forecasts. We have relatively cheap natural gas. And so what are you advising your clients? Because it seems to me a lot of these technologies face sort of catastrophic risk. And governments might get tired of paying for them.
That's a very good question. Natural gas is really, is poised to play an incredibly important, make an incredibly important impact on the clean energy sector. I guess my first piece of advice, and we don't specifically advise clients on how to deal with their projects. We try to lay out industry trends, but my one suggestion would be get a good renewable energy credit long-term sales agreement in place, and be operating in a state with a current renewable portfolio standard on the books. I mean, that is the way you can make the economics on a wind project work where otherwise would not necessarily. So I think that's sort of the short-term answer. The long-term answer is, look, the technologies are getting better. Particularly what's going on with solar is very exciting. I mean, the rate at which the Chinese are helping to drive down the cost per watt of solar down to like $1.70 out of the factory now is just pretty incredible. And so, you know, I think longer term, if this trend continues, renewables are poised to give even natural gas a run for the money, but I think you're right. We are probably, and we don't forecast natural gas prices, but it does appear likely that we're heading into a longer period of lower priced natural gas, and in fairness, should play an important role in dealing with climate change. I think the administration is focused very much on clean energy, but renewables, but natural gas does have an important role to play in our energy matrix.
Just in terms of the research that we've been producing, I think we have hit a high watermark at the end of last year in terms of climate change and clean energy commitment. I mean, there is already quite a lot of pushback around the world. But just as when we hit the last high watermark in the late 90s, that led through to a lot of momentum. That led through to the emissions trading scheme in Europe and so on. So I think the momentum is still there. And I think, again, I think we sort of forget at our peril the sort of the volatility that we've had in energy prices already. So I think the momentum remains, but it's going to be much more focused around sort of cost effectiveness than we've seen at the moment. And maybe if I could just focus, I didn't know, Lars, if you were talking about the UK. I mean, the UK, all new coal-fired plants now have to not actually be CCS ready, but actually have to have CCS applied. This is in a country which has a cap-and-trade regime. The prices are seen to be too low for that. There's a lot of talk in Europe about having floor prices, carbon taxes coming in. So I think that seems to be certainly the view from Europe that you need to have carbon regulation for coal plus ETS plus carbon tax.
Marie Salino from Northrop Grumman. This is for Mr. Book, but anyone is welcome to comment. You talked about nuclear. Have you looked at the economics of thorium reactors as opposed to uranium reactors, which are relatively cleaner and have different kind of potential?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Yes, we have. There's the generating costs. Again, we, like I think everyone else, prepare our best estimates of levelized generating costs. The problem with the thorium reactor from an estimating and projecting point of view is just not having data. We don't have installed costs. We don't see what O&M is. We don't know. We can look at in all nuclear power, fuel is an incidental cost relative to the cost of capital and the upfront overnight costs. The much lower upfront overnight costs at, for example, the smaller scale, not just of thorium reactors, but also of, I forget, it's just dropped out of my head, but the name of the company that has a small nuclear application. Babcock and Wilcox has just recently been trotting out a very small nuclear reactor relative to sort of the scale of some of the ESBWRs and some of the big guys that are out there now. And, you know, on a generating cost basis, it's not unsubsidized, competitive with any fossil fuel. None of them are. On the other hand, on an unsubsidized basis, some of these smaller nuclear applications beat wind. It really depends on what your assumptions are about plant life and how willing you are to amortize the levelization across a longer than financing period, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. That reactor will be there a long time.
Hi, Kate Zeile with the Georgetown Climate Center. I'm interested in the role that the U.S. states are playing in distributing the stimulus money. Kevin mentioned that they were choking on the influx of money, and I'm curious how that's working and how well that's working and if there are any interesting differences in the way states are handling the stimulus money.
We've only looked at 5 states. 50 is too big for our research team. We'd only created 6 jobs last year with the stimulus. And so of the 5 states, almost all of them are doing a bad job except for Connecticut. And when I say bad job, they're all doing good jobs. But bad jobs in terms of the efficiency and throughput with which the money is distributed. Connecticut's model is interesting in the sense that they actually subcontract directly to private entities. Most of the other states work with NGOs who then subcontract. And the difference is really one of the profit motive, looking at big money and getting involved. And so Connecticut's been very good in general about its efficiency and renewables deployment. But literally you have spotters going through neighborhoods looking for weatherization targets and bringing that back to the private contractor. That's a different outcome than some of the more central planning models, which are still moving slower.
Yeah, I would echo that. I was very fortunate enough to be out in Sacramento last week for the Clean Energy States Alliance meeting just before, managed to get home before the storm. But anyway, I heard a whole morning's worth of complaining about how hard it is to get this money out the door. And I think in fairness to these folks, they've been incredibly understaffed up until this point and still in many cases. But then there are some parts of the way the legislation were written that I think has really given people headaches. Some of the Buy American provisions are difficult to comply with. The NEPA requirements, I think, have been a challenge for a number of them. The Davis-Bacon Act requirements, these are all things that were chucked in there. I'm not sure by whom. My guess is by labor unions, environmentalists, others. But it has made it more difficult for them to actually get cash out the door. And I think it was, if I recall correctly, the state energy program, I think, which is only about 2% of the money has been, quote unquote, drawn down, actually gone out into the market. So that's why when I gave that fairly low number for the amount of money that's actually hit the street, that's in part because the state energy offices are having real trouble getting the money out the door. And it's not their fault. The legislation is just not written in a way that makes it really easy.
Hi, Rebecca Henson with Calvert Investments. Can you hear me? Okay. Okay, great. So my question is more, I guess, towards Nick, particularly because it's on public equity investments. How hard is it to properly assign valuations to companies to pick leaders and laggards or winners and losers? And let's just say, for example, in the electric utility sector, that takes into account climate change, risks and opportunities, but in light of governments like the U.S. that essentially want all companies to progress and to have a cleaner, lighter footprint. Specifically, I'm thinking about Southern yesterday, the announcement of the DOE loan support. And Southern is not typically a company that has been a leader in nuclear. I might think of Exelon or Entergy or some of these other companies that are not only leaders in nuclear but also are very supportive of climate change legislation in the U.S. So what kind of, I guess, game changer is it? How do we actually value a company based on climate change actions when it seems like the government is kind of stepping in and trying to help everyone progress and make everyone kind of leaders?
Thanks for the question. I'm not an equity analyst. I'm more of a sort of strategist. In terms of our public equity coverage, it's mostly in Europe and emerging markets. We don't cover a whole heap of stocks here in the States. So I can really speak from our experience in Europe, whereby I suppose analysts now have been routinely incorporating carbon prices for five or more years, particularly in terms of renewables pricing as well. And many analysts are actually now not just developing, I suppose, pools of stocks based on traditional sustainability screens, but actually are changing some of the fundamental valuation metrics in terms of cost of capital and revenues and so on. So I can't speak, unfortunately, for the U.S. because we don't cover equity stocks here in large part. Thank you.
Alan Tonnelson with the U.S. Business and Industry Council. It's a question mainly for Julian Wong, but all comments would be welcome. I didn't hear a lot in your presentation about the very pervasive and very considerable subsidies that the Chinese government provides in terms of not only fuel but water for manufacturing of all kinds, which has been going on for a long, long time, and which certainly drives down the, which not only drives down manufacturing costs, but which encourages fuel and water use. Of course, also, China has been subsidizing the gasoline prices. They've recently been, I guess, lowering them in various steps. But about a month or two ago, they actually raised them once again. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about how this larger strategy of manufacturing fuel subsidization fits into the big picture about how green China is really becoming.
Thanks for the question. So, you know, one of the things that I didn't get to talk about is how Chinese leaders sort of see the process of going on this low-carbon strategy unfolding in the next couple of decades. And I think there is a consensus, essentially, that one of the necessary things to do, in spite of all this development of clean energy projects and energy efficiency, is to basically effect a fundamental restructuring of the whole economy away from heavy industry towards lighter industry and services. And really what's underpinning this sort of tendency for heavy industry and heavy manufacturing is, I think, as you outlined astutely, the factors cost, the cost of production, whether it's natural resources, whether it's fuel, whether it's water, And certainly labor is one of them, but that's a different discussion. So let's stick to the raw materials and fuel. There is a understanding that, you know, China cannot persist in its policies of heavily subsidizing natural resources, particularly fuel and water. And so, in fact, in terms of gasoline and petrol, China has over the course of the past year and a half, released its controls of the prices of gasoline, and basically come up with a formula that subjects it to market price. So the general tendency is for gasoline prices to have gone up in the past year and a half. It has fluctuated a little bit. That reflects more the volatility of crude in the markets, but the overall tendency is for it to go up. At one point, gasoline was more expensive in China on a per gallon basis than it was in the U.S. And it has coupled that with policies that provide tax breaks for smaller, more efficient cars and raise taxes for less efficient cars. So there's that element of looking at supportive policies to that. And on water, you know, that is a very highly politically sensitive issue. And the issue is that the sort of perceived right to free water really underpins the social stability of the rural communities, which, although economically is diminishing in its importance, politically and socially is extremely important for the political stability of the party in power. And so, you know, it's going to be, you're starting to see cities across China starting to raise their tariff rates on water, but it's going to be a slow and gradual process, and even slower if you're talking about water reform in rural areas. So there are a lot of political considerations as well that make it complicated. But I think it is on the leaders' minds. They're just going to figure out a way and strategy that fits their political circumstances.
We've got time for just a couple more questions. So maybe what we'll do is take like two or three of them. So one and two, and then you have had your hand up for a long time. So
hi, my name is Will Pearson. I'm with Eurasia Group. I have a question for Ethan. And I guess it just starts with the wind turbine supply to exceed demand. I was wondering what policies you assume. Is it only the current state-level policies that you assume to be in place and not a renewable energy standard for the country? And also I'm curious if you believe that the current grant in lieu of tax credit, if that's going to be maintained after this year, or if you think it'll be a reversion to the tax credits.
Okay, and then right here, Lee.
In terms of our projection, no, we're not basing it on an assumption of a national RES. In terms of whether the tax, the grant gets extended, I stepped out for a moment, but Kevin tells me that Sandalo said that he was asked about this, and he basically didn't sound very supportive of the idea. So my estimate about whether or not it happens this year has just gone down a bit. we thought it was a bit of a long shot anyway. I mean, Senator Bingaman is not a supporter of that policy. He never was. And so, insofar as he is pretty important to making energy policy, we don't think that, I think the chances are less likely that that's going to happen this year. Okay. Although I'm still somewhat optimistic, probably better than even odds, that we'll actually get a renewable electricity standard this year.
Okay, let's hear these two questions and then we'll take them together.
Good morning, Amy Bo, Hess Corporation. This question is for Julian Wong. You mentioned China's commitment to reduce the emissions intensity of its economy by 45% by 2020. I was wondering, to what extent does this represent an additional effort above the government's existing policy to reduce the energy intensity of its economy?
Okay. And then right back there. And then Lee.
Hi, this is Lauren.
Yeah. You're good, yeah.
Lauren Dennis from the Alliance to Save Energy. My question is for Kevin Book, the white elephant in the room. As an efficiency advocate, I wanted to ask you to expand on your idea that efficiency is the enemy of clean energy economy, or the expansion of clean energy, with diminishing fuel supplies and an ever-increasing energy demand, even with efficiency programs as being successful. It seems that efficiency could never take away from the need for renewables to enter into our market in a more greater mix. So if you could expand on your claim there. Thanks.
Okay, and the final question right here.
Yes, would you comment on sort of the rationality of the proposed $54 billion in, from the Federal Financing Bank to go to new nuclear capacity? It's mostly in the Southeast. The Southeast has the lowest GNP per unit of electrical output in the country. So, you know, if efficiency in that region is available at 5 cents per kilowatt hour and under, and new nuclear capacity is available at 15 cents to 25 cents a kilowatt hour, what is the administration doing by allocating $54 billion in fresh capital to this end? It doesn't make sense, in my view.
Okay. Anyone want to take any one of those questions?
I'll go first with the China carbon intensity targets. You know, your question is really the question that a lot of folks in the think tank community have tried to unpack and really tried to determine. It's as you can imagine, it's difficult to really ascertain what is business as usual and what is not. I guess part of it is the definition. What China had on its books in terms of laws, specific laws on climate, emissions-related policies, the most concrete was its energy efficiency target to reduce energy intensity by 20% from 2006 to 2010. There was, and it didn't really go far beyond 2010. So to the extent that this new carbon intensity target requires the government to extend its energy efficiency targets and maybe sustain its renewable energy deployment targets beyond 2010, then one could argue that that is additional policy. On the other hand, I guess the counter argument is that the renewable energy targets go to 2020, so that, you know, that isn't new, unless you're talking about them revising those targets. But I think they made the announcements to revise those targets earlier in the year rather than before they announced the carbon intensity targets. Then the question is, you know, in terms of energy efficiency, you know, would they have, you know, extended those policies beyond 2010 anyways? And I guess the consensus is probably they would have, because if you look at some other less specific documents in terms of their medium long-term plans, they do talk about energy efficiency as a very important forward policy. I think those who suggest that this is not anything more than business as usual rely a lot on the IEA numbers, the World Energy Outlook, which provides very bullish numbers about China's ability to be more efficient as an economy. But a lot of the other analysis would point to maybe a business as usual scenario of maybe 38-39% reduction in carbon intensity as what would happen without this carbon intensity target. I think the more important thing really, I think measuring carbon emissions per unit of economic output is just a very problematic climate change indicator. I mean, I just don't like it at all to begin with. It's unfortunately a political compromise. At some point, China is going to have to start thinking about peaking its emissions and capping emissions, because ultimately that's what the atmosphere cares about. But what is important is that by committing to measuring carbon emissions for the first time, this is the first policy to do it, hopefully that will get them in the practice of measuring, reporting, verifying their emissions and making them feel more comfortable about a carbon management program and get them on a path to actually capping emissions.
Suppose I'll tackle the question that was addressed to me. The enemy of renewable energy is a strong and controversial way to put it, but it's true right now because of the way commodities price. Energy commodities, like all commodities, price on a hyperbolic curve. And so 2% savings when you're at the top of the curve is a tremendous asset in terms of the price reduction. 2% savings when you're at the bottom of the curve changes things very little because you have very little price sensitivity to demand. Where we are right now is in a situation where I think at least two of us have suggested that OECD electric power demand and fuels demand are peaking and will soon decline. I think I have a slightly more bullish assessment of at least North American electric power demand going up a little bit. And the room for efficiency as part of the mix is harder to look at as a complement, and it becomes more of a competitor when you have a smaller pie because efficiency's made the pie smaller. The other way to think about it is that these are all, I think it was is Ethan, at the levelized cost graph that said, you know, look, all of these new sources, really any new source, is high on a levelized cost basis relative to an incumbent source. So your cost of saving electricity has fallen, according to ACEE, to 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour in 14 states that they surveyed. Also, if you count how much that changed things, it was about 0.54% of sales in those 14 states, suggesting that maybe they weren't really going for it. There's room in this country for huge efficiency gains. The problem is that if you succeed in even small efficiency gains, you're undercutting the economic case for the highest priced new fuels, whatever they are, be transportation or electric power. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It makes the green sources more competitive immediately. But if you're trying to help a fledgling industry along, it makes it harder to evolve.
I would just add one comment on that from the policy perspective also, which is that this the renewable electricity standard that's currently before Congress, I'm trying to remember if it's the House or the Senate version, but sets a 20% clean energy target by 2020, but then 40% of that can be met by energy efficiency. In my view, that could be the most important energy efficiency legislation ever passed if it goes through, because what will happen is just as Kevin's saying, utilities, if they're under the gun to meet these requirements, are going to go for the cheapest stuff first, and that's always efficiency. And that will put off investment in renewables. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but if you want to, you know, if you want to put, you know, hundreds of thousands of guys in hard hats building wind turbines, then you need to be aware of the impact of the competition between EE and RE.
Well, I think, I'm sorry, the last question on nuclear.
Competition EE and nuclear.
Yeah. Did you want to take that, Kevin, or?
That was a very interesting question because local governments control the cost of power to the ratepayers, and the federal government controls the cost of credit for those who want to build nuclear facilities. And the 10th Amendment's a real problem in energy policy, always has been, from transmission to just about everything else. But what the premise of your question is, power's cheap, it's coal-fired, and these folks are poor. What are you doing dropping high-cost sources on top of them? I'm not sure that is the best policy. The economic case for that high-cost power has to be approved locally by the PUC, and they have to have, at a local level, a willingness to undertake it if it's a regulated entity. And if it's a merchant generator trying to sell 15-cent power into a 5-cent market, I'm not sure I'd like them long as a stock holding.
All right. Well, this has been really great. Thank you all for your time, and thank our excellent panelists for their time and presentations.